Okay. Thank you so much, Matt, for that really generous introduction. And thanks, so big thanks to the organizers of this event, this workshop with such an important and urgent team. And I'm really happy to have been invited here, and I also feel extremely honored to have been given the chance to offer first input to our conversations over these coming couple of days. Is the sound okay? Because I get the feedback, so it sounds quite weird to me. Is it too loud? Yeah. If I just hold it a bit further away? Is this okay? I still get a little bit of feedback, but...
Because we have also more... Yeah. Is it okay?
Yeah. Just signal if it becomes too loud or too low or something. Okay. So, yes, thank you, Annette, for the introduction. And it was interesting that you went for that image of Sweden, because in our analysis, I think that that image itself is also what somehow is part of generating these tendencies in Sweden. So I will come back to that as well. So here today I will mainly present some of the ideas put forward in the article Safety for Whom that Annette talked about, that I wrote together with Jana Molinari. He's a professor of gender studies, also based at Lund University. And in this article we put together a few different strands of work. My own work has mainly, up until that point when we wrote the article at least, been on borders and migrants' rights and migrants' movements, and kind of processes of irregularization of migrants. And in that work, analyzing the discourses and the public conversation about migration and borders, that's where I got my eyes on this, the way that these conversations and these debates were increasingly gendered, increasingly filled with this anti-feminist tendencies in different ways. And also, as a part of that, a demonization of migrant men. So we've brought together that kind of strand of work, and then Diana's work that was more on this anti-racist feminist activism. And also, we brought together different kinds of materials. We have interviews and media debate, and tried to think them together as located in this link between anti-feminism and anti-immigration sentiments in Sweden. So to do that, we work with the concept of care work and also the concept of safety that I will explain a bit closer in a bit, how we use it, and femo-nationalism that I think you are very familiar with already as a concept. And these concepts help us to see some continuities in this field of anti-gender, anti-feminism that is so full of contradictions. But still contains some continuities between the more mainstream right and the far right, and also sadly to strands of left thinking and feminist thinking as well. So I have to ask again, is the sound okay? Because I get this echo all the time, so it sounds really... Can you hear in all the parts of the room? Yeah. Or? What should I... Further away or closer? I don't know. Okay. If anyone has an idea how to fix the sound, let me know. Otherwise, I continue like this. So, as I said, I will mainly go into our article, but before I get there, I would like to frame these concepts and our argument in two steps. First, to say a few words about the kind of blurry field of anti-feminism more in general, and then say something about the specific shape of these developments in Sweden. So, my talk here today has the title Blurring Boundaries, Rearticulations of Anti-Feminism in the Context of Right-Wing Mobilizations in Europe. And what we're dealing with here is certainly a very blurry field in terms of ideas, ideological and organizational roots, etc. But these voices, movements, ideas and fears from so different places and contexts globally are still appearing with rather a lot of continuities and similarities. And here, this is a quote from the introduction to a Science Spring issue from this year, a special issue on gender and the rise of the global right, So another recent initiative, just like this workshop, to get together and start to think together on this, on the issues of anti-feminism and gender conservatism. So here in the introduction to this special issue, the editors, Agnieszka Graf, Ratana Kalbud, and Susanna Walters, draw some first contours around this blurriness in the introduction. And they argue that anti-gender and anti-feminist are the specific ideas that create continuity within the fragmented field of the global, of the growing global right. So they say, gender conservatism has in recent years become the lingua franca of an otherwise diverse global trend. It's what brings together right-wing activists from otherwise distant walks of life. Believers and non-believers, nationalists and universalists, populists who demonize global capital, and traditional Reagan-Thatcher-style conservatives with a neocon love for the market. So, while the new global right is by no means a unified political movement, there does exist a global anti-feminism. So they argue that it's the anti-feminism, the anti-genderism, that is the kind of glue that keeps this global right together, despite their differences in terms of ideological roots and origins. So to add to this already messy combination of ideological roots and ideas that make up this global right and anti-feminism, Kowalczyk and Agnieszka Graf discuss in another article the ways in which these groups and movements increasingly are adopting both an anti-colonial discourse and a discourse against neoliberalism. So in these discourses, feminism and gender ideology is, as they call it, I mean gender ideology with quotation marks, is seen as a part of the neoliberal project and as being imposed through neocolonial relations between the global north and south. So as you can see, it's picking up actually some critical points that we actually are exploring in feminist debates with concerns about the ways in which Western ideas is imposed in global south through colonial relations and so on. So here is like a first point of a kind of blurriness where this, of course, it's not the same kind of critique, but it's kind of loosely inspired by these critiques. And they say, within this framework, feminism is presented as an integral part of neoliberalism, while the traditional family becomes the last frontier of resistance, a place where there is still hope and a sense of community. Relying on an anti-colonial frame, the right has undermined the left-wing monopoly on voicing critiques of capitalism and has offered a new version of cultural universalism, an illiberal one. In short, anti-genderism has become the new language of anti-capitalist mobilization. And another of these elements of argumentation that creates a kind of blurriness between anti-feminism and feminism is the way in which the anti-feminism has to some extent picked up elements of our feminist arguments. So it can be picking up from those strands of feminists that lean towards some kind of gender essentialism, but also the general way of using rights discourses in feminism and human rights. So for example, the way in which the mobilization against free choice about abortion has been phrased in rights terms as a right to life, for example. And Graf, Kappel and Walter say in the introduction to science again, right-wing advocacy has been able to utilize and build upon forms of feminist advocacy based on gender essentialism, especially in the area of violence against women, to justify the difference in the treatment of women. So, if we then move to Sweden and try to think about how these general developments, what more specific kind of shape do they take in the Swedish context. And the first thing I put here is what Annette mentioned as well, it's that we move in a political context in which this idea about Sweden being the best country in the world is really strong.
And this kind of Scandinavian or Nordic welfare model has not only been analyzed as a successful welfare regime, but also specifically as a regime that has been seen as kind of women-friendly welfare state. To the extent that it has become a really strong part of a kind of national self-image, so it's seen as something inherent to Swedish society at this point, kind of whatever happens with actual redistribution of resources. The feminism and the gender equality is seen as something inherent in Swedish society. And similarly, this kind of image in relation to human rights and Sweden's role in the global community somehow is very often emphasized as this best country in the world. So anti-racist and post-colonial feminist scholars have in the Swedish context pointed out how this kind of success story about Swedish gender equality has somehow transformed into a kind of a national boundary marker or something like that, a category that creates ideas about the national, inherently gender equal we that is defined against the inherently non-equal other. And I know this is, of course, a parallel to this kind of debates in many European countries, but I think this the persuasiveness of this idea in Sweden is possibly even stronger. So this image prevails despite a neoliberal turn in Sweden, just like in other welfare states, since many decades. And the shift and the turn towards the dismantling of the welfare state has very much gone hand in hand with discourses that represent migrants as a burden on the welfare state and as unable to adapt to kind of Western or Swedish values of equality. And it's also, these developments have also gone hand in hand with the introduction of more restrictive migration controls that have in many ways decreased rights of migrants and asylum seekers. And this same period of dismantling of welfare state has also had seen primarily two kind of periods of increased extreme right mobilization. So starting in the late 80s and peaking early 90s, like in many other places around Europe, the extreme right mobilization increased a lot. And there was for the first time a right-wing populist party that came into the parliament as well in that time. That party is gone now, but in the same period the Sweden Democrats were also established and started growing and kind of continued growing, even if this kind of peak of extreme right support went down for a bit, but then they started growing again and they entered the parliament in the 2010 elections and have been growing steadily since then. And together with the growth of the parliamentarian far right, we also always see the mobilization of the more kind of fascist and extreme right and neo-Nazi groups. And the Sweden Democrats is often conceptualized within political science as belonging to the family of European populist radical right parties, but in some scholars in Sweden have wanted to label them as racist or fascist due to the historical roots with these 80s and 90s neo-Nazi social movements. So this is kind of the stage of the developments with anti-gender in Sweden. A very strong idea about an already extremely successful gender equality. And also in relation to this, a kind of an idea that as feminism or as gender equality is already has arrived, all other kinds of feminism are too extreme. So somehow in this, with this idea that that gender equality is already in place, that same understanding also kind of pushes forward is the anti-feminist tendency to some extent. And very much both in the kind of extreme right, but also in the liberal right and conservative right, the critique of feminism is very much about not specifically, not fully taking distance from the idea of gender equality, but more dividing what they see as feminist movements into kind of real feminism that only deal with kind of gender equality between statistics between men and women, and then what they see as some kind of extreme feminism that think intersectionally, that include anti-racism in their analysis, queer theory and so on. So the debate is rarely purely opposing gender equality, but more opposing what is described as kind of extreme forms of feminism. And one more element that I've put here that I see as specific to the political field in Sweden is this kind of consensus culture, a tradition with very strong cooperations between social movements and the state. And that has built a really a kind of political culture of trust in the state, which always also becomes a kind of stake in the shape that political debates are developing. So to in the article that I will turn to soon, the examples are about anti-feminism are closely related to the period of around 2016 with the so-called refugee crisis. But I will here just to illustrate a little bit more this kind of the shape of anti-feminism in Sweden, I will just show some examples of more kind of recent developments. So here is a picture from a recruitment campaign from the Swedish Armed Forces that is in the streets right now in Sweden. So you see, so this is to kind of underscore this idea about how gender equality is so strongly linked to the state. So I don't know the name of military grades in English, but a person from the army with the feminist earring and trying to recruit new people to the army, come as you are, says the text. So somehow this invites this kind of strong identification of gender equality as being a product of the state and as inherent to the state. It does two things. First, it invites the kind of second wave feminist movements to summarize their struggles in terms of a success story, as I already mentioned. And second, they also become kind of invited to identify with the state and to regard it as kind of as a feminism that is coming from the state rather than the state held accountable by feminist movements, for example. So I think this picture is, just shows quite clearly this relation between state and the idea about what feminism can be and what equality can be. And then here, this is also very recent. It's from a debate article from the Christian Democrat leader Ebba Busch Thor, where she also creates this link not just between Sweden and gender equality, but Sweden as a Christian, which is something that isn't so often put forward in Swedish debate. This kind of connection to religion is quite rare as an argument in public debate. But here she connects Sweden, Christianity to values such as democracy and gender equality and even sexual liberation. So she includes quite a lot here in her idea about what Christianity has made Sweden into. So she says this is a part of a debate article where she argues that we need that Christianity is needed as a value in kind of urban suburbs with a lot of social exclusion to kind of recuperate the cultural problems in those areas. So it's a very violent text. In the same time as she kind of communicates with all these values that she attaches to Sweden. So she says, all the liberties and rights that we want to protect in Sweden have been taken shape upon a Christian foundation. Not only the freedom of speech, the freedom of association, the freedom of religion, the right state and the democracy, but also individualism, gender equality and the sexual liberation. And I also think it's interesting that she's a kind of neoconservative femininity that hasn't, it's a new kind of public figure that we haven't had so many of before that are coming up at this point, I think. And then one more element of anti-feminism at the moment is this a more specific kind of attack on gender studies as an academic discipline. So this is a journalist from one of the kind of main conservative newspapers, or liberal conservative, maybe they call it, call them. And he, this is his crowdfunding, where he wants to crowdfund to write a book where he is, kind of analyzes what he calls the gender ideology. He says, on the crowdfunding page, he says, in my new book, I want to look into how gender ideology, with the help of the politicians, take over Swedish universities, research and education. And he has been writing on these topics for quite a while, always connecting, always making this kind of his description or his understanding of what gender ideology is as a kind of connected cluster between gender studies and academia, gender equality policies, and feminist social movements and civil society. So he's kind of approaching this as a kind of a organized cooperation between all of those elements. He's quite approaching this as a with a quite what do you say, conspiracy theoretical frame. And he raised 722,200, so that's like 75,000 euros. Anyway, it's not so much about him specifically, but I think this is yet another kind of anti-feminism that is growing, and it's picking up from this. So it's very much relating to the populist kind of the right wing populist idea about feminism or any kind of anti-racism or queer movements as not representing the common man. So always understanding this, the common man who want to be allowed or able to express certain opinions is always put at the center, and is implicitly always a white heterosexual, mostly often a man as well. And all these other strands of thought are seen as silencing this common man. And this is a quite strong sentiment in the Swedish debate at the moment. So this guy, but also other people, are always, I mean, they use a lot of space in media to talk about all the things that they claim that they are not allowed to talk about, saying that there is no space for these discussions, and gender ideology is controlling the conversation and so on. So kind of under this flag of promoting an open conversation where all kinds of ideas and voices are allowed to come in, a lot of this right-wing and anti-feminist conversations are actually done under that, the kind of flag of those ideas. So that's where I wanted. And it's also because he and a few other figures like this also creates this kind of bridge between mainstream conservatives and the far right. So he is someone who has been writing for years in this, it's conservative, but still a mainstream paper. And we have a few other public figures like that who have been much more mainstream and just recently started to move to the right really fast. And even if they don't leave their platforms, you can see like the networks they are creating around them, the invitations they get to where they talk, who they talk with, and so on. So you can see the kind of a growing public far-right intellectual network somehow growing as well. So that was a little bit the kind of about anti-gender, anti-feminism more general, and then the shape of these developments in Sweden. And now I want to turn to our article. So to analyze the field of anti-feminism, we then think that all these elements that I have been mentioning here needs to be included: the dismantling of the welfare state, the growing support for racist and anti-immigration ideas. And we have worked with a few concepts that we think we can use to kind of capture these different developments together. And as I mentioned, in this article we bring together earlier work, and that in my studies of more focusing on bordering processes. Of course, this period around what was often called the refugee crisis, in the article we have called it the solidarity crisis instead, to turn the gaze around on what kind of crisis we witnessed in 2015-2016. Of course, that was a period where border controls, refugee reception, migration and integration became increasingly gendered. And after what happened in Köln, but also before that period, and also in relation to specific movements in Sweden. So, let's see. Yes, I will turn to the concept of care racism. So this concept was developed by Diana Melinari, that I've been working with, and Anders Negård, when they did a research project on women and people with immigrant background who were members of the Sweden Democrats. So they were inspired by postcolonial feminists who have pointed out that the role care work has had in legitimizing and naturalizing hierarchical relations in colonial and post-colonial settings. So the kind of when these conversations about caring for one's community, etc., came up more and more in these interviews with women active in the Sweden Democrats, they started to turn to this kind of interventions in relation to care. So they use the concept to describe the ways in which the logic of family ties and logics of positive emotions, so love and care, logics that regulates the tradition of family and its division of labor, based on an understanding of men as protectors and women as caring. They describe how these logics function as a central frame for the far right and conservative parties, and then especially for the women active in this party. So the notions of kind of caring for our own are articulated, particularly among the female members of these parties, and also broader racist social movements. So what they found interesting in this in the material that they gathered with these interviews was that the right-wing racist agendas in the conversations with these women, they were not articulated through discourses of hate towards the others, but instead they were framed by notions of care and love for the family and for the community. So the female members of the Sweden Democrats describe themselves as driven by a desire to care for the ones they understand as Swedes, who are in need of protection from the threats of those defined as outsiders. But this sense of care and acting out of care and out of love also extends to the national community. So to the natural community and to the kind of to protecting and caring for these alleged core values of the nation, of the national community. And in this sense, this care racist articulations even in some aspects reach out towards being a kind of presented as a kind of care for the other. So they have in the material they have these quotes of how people describe that harsh immigration policy or forced deportations actually can be for the best for everyone because it doesn't work with the mixing cultures and things like that. So they somehow argue for these very violent policies and very violent divisions and categorizations of people, but they base their arguments on the concern for both their close family, their kind of imagined natural community, and the values that they argue that Sweden want to uphold, so to say. So here comes in how kind of feminist, I won't call them feminist, but feminist inspired ideas or kind of gender equality in that way can be also has been mobilized in this sense of becoming part of what is described as what they want to protect, what they want to care for, in the same time as having a kind of anti-immigration or racist stance. So, let's see. Yeah, I will move on to the next one. So, and they also see how this the care racism is gendered in the way that it is an articulation, a way of formulating politics that enables women to enter and be in the far right movements while still keeping the conservative gender ideas in place. So while women mobilizing politically in a kind of conservative gender division would not really fit in, hence excluding women, which these movements, of course, historically have done to a large extent. This position of a racist formulated through values of care becomes a possible kind of position gendered as feminine in this context. So they write, the concept of caring racism follows in this post-colonial feminist tradition by identifying care as a floating signifier successfully appropriated by the racist party. Can racists be caring? Our informant's answer to the question is yes. We agree with them on a number of issues. Racist parties provide an epistemic community where people care for each other. Members of racist parties use their time and resources for what they think are the common good, the caring of their people. Caring is the promise of a Swedish people's home that the social democratic regime failed to provide. So this people's home is the kind of old social democratic kind of word to describe this, the welfare project in Sweden. And the caring creates subject positions both for women as caring mothers and for men as protectors and caring fathers of the nation. Furthermore, the SD supporters in our study construct their exclusion and separation from the racialized other, not only as caring for the self, for our own, but also as caring for them, preserving their purity as the other. So, as I said, to kind of argue that it's best for everyone to not have multiculturalism, but it's also then I think that this concept also enables capturing other elements of this kind of racism in relation to the other, when different kinds of interventions in the lives of the other is legitimized from this place of care. And why I think it's interesting here and what we are looking at here, it's because it also captures the continuity between extreme right anti-feminist stances and more mainstream and liberal such stances, as you can see how this interpretation of care becomes a link between these different stances. And okay, let's see, time wise you said 4:15 or so. Here you also discuss this how it enables certain kinds of femininities, but then connected to care racism in this specific analysis, we also found the concept of safety as a word that came back all the time. It's closely connected, the way it's used is closely connected to the concept of care racism. So we choose to express this with the Swedish word trygghet, and that's because this word has become a word filled with a much larger range of connotations than what the translation to safety alone allows us to express. So we understand this word as representing a kind of racialized nostalgia for an imagined former version of the welfare state captured by this concept that I mentioned before, folkhem, at the people's home. So in this way, the kind of an imagined kind of pre-migration homogeneous Sweden is what this word of this specific word of trygghet appeals to, the kind of idea that of a homogeneous Sweden that used to be before migration. So of course it's both a concept that makes invisible a lot of the actual Swedish history, but also implicitly places blame on the migration as producing social conflict. So in the Sweden Democrats agenda, they also refer a lot to this concept of trygghet. They said you should be able to feel safe at work, safe in school, and safe from getting old. But the most important is the physical security. You should not need to be afraid of being a victim of crime, whether at home or in public places. And of course, these words in themselves do not explicitly have these racial connotations, but in the context of their larger presentations of their policies and how they understand the development in Sweden, that is the meaning. So it takes a point of departure from this kind of nostalgic fantasy of an idealized welfare state of the past, which provided for everyone in a homogeneous white society. So, and then we also look at the concept of femo and the homonationalism. But I think I will not go in on that because I think you have been working with that concept quite a lot. So, during the winter of 2015 and 16, in Sweden, like I imagine here, and in many places around in Europe, one could follow a drastic shift in relation to the category of asylum seekers and refugees in general, but undocumented migrants and unaccompanied minors in particular. So this is kind of the field that I was studying, and also where I could see these sudden shifts in the representations of this group. Because at this point, just before what was called the refugee crisis, these categories of undocumented migrants and unaccompanied minors had had increasingly started to enter the conversations on welfare and social policies as categories of inhabitants. This was at that point a categorization that had been used mainly by social welfare officers or organizations representing unaccompanied minors. But in that period of the crisis, this category, specifically the one unaccompanied minor, transformed into a stigmatized category described as destructive for the society very, very quickly. So this pattern that we see all over Europe with the demonization of migrant men and the simultaneous total invisibility of migrant women was the kind of content of that shift. And in our analysis, we mainly focus on two phenomena that had a really central stage, so to say, in these debates. And one was the exponential growth of the racialized narratives around sexual harassment in the aftermath of the events in Köln. And the other was comments and questions about the gender balance on the dangerous sea routes across the Mediterranean Sea. So although these issues of gender equality are normally not a very high priority on the agendas of extreme right and racist fascist movements and forums, in 2016, when if you searched on the internet for where are the women and immigration, suddenly a huge interest was revealed in this kind of statistical gender equality in these extreme right forums. So here is a kind of gendered intervention straight into the kind of bordering process. So suddenly entries on extreme right sites started to ask why there are not more women on the boats crossing the Mediterranean to get to Europe. But these arguments were raised in a way that did not at all deal with the issue of how women's rights would be best protected. So this was easily detected as a focus, that the focus of these blogs were not actually migrant women's safety, but migrant men. So this is just one example. Where are the women and children? It's from an extreme right website. But this kind of undermining the credibility of men as refugees for asking these questions about women in the boats were not only, it was very much discussed in this kind of extreme right for us. But it wasn't only addressed in those spaces, but also in more mainstream contexts. So this is a person who is he calls himself a feminist kind of educator, and he travels around to schools and educate people about feminism. So he's one, as I don't know if you have that expression in Germany, but we have an expression that is dad feminist, daddy feminists, and that men who formerly haven't thought so much about gender equality, but then they have a daughter and start to get worried about sexism because they have someone that they're worried about. He's one of them, and he travels around in Swedish schools to educate children about gender equality. But he's also taking part on this kind of take on gender equality, where he very much uses both the idea of Sweden as gender equal, the kind of creates this negative image of migrant men. So he So three elements are brought together in this quote. I will read the quote first. Sweden would like to celebrate itself as an exemplary country for gender equality. Our government proudly says that Sweden has the world's first feminist government with gender equality on both the national and international agenda. But never have gender equality policies been so absent in the government's refugee policy. Of the 163,000 refugees who sought asylum in Sweden in 2015, 70% were men. Among the 35,000 unaccompanied children, over 90% were boys. My own daughter asked me where the girls and the mothers were. How do you answer such a question? It's not as if 70% of the population is male and 90% of children are boys in these countries. So how do you answer your daughter? In order to apply for asylum in Sweden, you have to get to Sweden. It just seems these men and their sons do this. While women and girls are treated by these men, that are the ones that should care for them, as being completely safe from the wars, chemical warfare and famine in their countries. It does not take much of a thinking person to conclude that this can hardly be called an international gender equality policy. So he's very much picking up the same kind of patterns that us more critical feminists would use against this the image of Sweden as gender equal. But then he turns to this very harsh anti-immigration take, where he makes this analysis fully excluding so much of the context of the conditions of flight and migration to Europe. So he argues that he's writing in defense of the values of care and equality, which are understood as central to narratives of Sweden. And he also defines gender equality in one-dimensional terms, focusing on numbers and leaving all other contexts and variables aside, such as European border regimes, conditions of war, etc. And then he places this problem on migrant men and their attitudes towards women with this kind of cynical representation of refugee men as uncaring and as men who don't prioritize their daughters' lives above their own. So here you can see how this the notion of both trygghet, safety and care becomes fundamental in his way of arguing and his way of categorizing people in this kind of situation. So while the extreme right and this people like this debater were arguing in this way, also even more kind of mainstream liberal feminists were catching on this discussion. So these quotes are both from the period right after Köln, where you can see very clearly how they kind of talk to this these ideas about Sweden. And what is important here is that these statements are made in a situation when Swedish government just had decided to radically close, more or less close the borders and pull down the level of asylum rights to an absolute minimum. So the context of these kind of arguments is a situation when a really sharp turn is already happening in Swedish migration politics. So these kind of arguments, of course, come in and reinforce that kind of turn and reinforce the idea that this was a necessary step for Sweden to take to keep kind of a Swedish society floating and so on. So, but then, as I said, we also have brought together these developments and these ways in which notions of safety and care are kind of co-opted for anti-immigration arguments. We have put them in the article, kind of put them next to statements from feminist activists who have experienced both this the hate and the violence, and also who in these interviews put forward a very different understanding of what safety can be. So they very strongly break with this idea about safety and care as provided, as available, as from the state, from the police, and so on, and instead create their own notions of safety through activism, through community, and kind of beyond national boundaries. So I don't know, these quotes are all quite long, and time is running out, so I will try to just summarize. So she's talking more like about how certain men are always in the media pointed out as being harassing women or being sexist, but then in her everyday life, the ones that send her threats on the internet and that is a threat to her safety, it's totally different men who it's white men who are threatening them in that way. And she means that this way of kind of turning the understanding of threat leaves, well, as she said, that leaves patriarchy intact the Swedish way. And here is another quote: the woman is talking about being a part of anti-Nazi demonstrations and being beaten by the police throughout the years, and through bringing up these memories and talking about these aspects of violence, the state, and safety, she also creates a kind of break with that notions of safety and as this state as a possible kind of the possibility to turn to the state in search of safety. Yeah, so these are also continuing in a similar way to question this nationalist, nativist understandings of safety. And then I think what you referred to when you, Annette, in the beginning about this similar movements in Sweden was this organization that actually was established in Finland first, but quickly was, the idea quickly traveled to Sweden, and I think it spread in Europe. A group of that called themselves Soldiers of Odin, so referring to the kind of Nordic god Odin, they established this group of kind of vigilante groups that the idea was to walk the streets to protect our women from threatening migrant men. And this initiative was first, I mean, it was both very, in some places they gathered and had their demonstrations, but in some cities they didn't even manage to walk because the counter demonstrations were much bigger. But we haven't traced that in the article, but we discussed this different kinds of campaigns and expressions where women take distance from this wish to protect them in this way, under the label not your woman or not in my name. So they say, I'm not your Swedish woman, I do not need protection. The only thing that makes me afraid is people like you in the streets and in the parliament. So just to sum up, I've tried to outline here how care racism within nationalist ideologies, this kind of idea we protect and care for our own, and the logics of feminationalism, so the gender equality as a national cultural value and the others as threatening the gender equality, how these entangle and bridge each other towards the construction of the figure of the vulnerable white Swedish woman, but also of the threatening feminist in the same time. And we also show how anti-racist feminists act upon these discourses, exploring other notions of vulnerability and security and safety. And at the center of these debates, we have seen throughout our analysis the notions of trygghet and safety and care. And we think it's central as feminists to keep asking questions about where we are looking for safety and from who and for who. So yeah, that's me. Thanks.